The Guardian.
Warning, this podcast contains graphic scientific details about how animals mate. Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of one of America's space milestones.
They wanted to avoid what they thought might be the most expensive funeral ever.
His name was Ham, and he came from French Cameroon.
There was a plan to stuff his skin and put it back inside this capsule on display.
Why the Higgs might be closer than ever.
We had a big discussion in our workshop in Chamonix about whether we should go from 3.5 TeV, which is where we run at the moment, to 4 TeV.
The decision's been made to keep the Large Hadron Collider up and running for another year before its scheduled maintenance. We cross live-ish to the room where the beam is switched on and off.
The performance of the detectors has been so good that they can very, very rapidly sift through the incredible quantities of data and find the new physics quickly. Now is the time to really push for the Higgs.
We continue this program's celebration of animals by talking about green porn with a movie star.
If I were a firefly, snail, spider, at the end of my slender body, my anus would end up on top of my head.
And someone's got a new book out.
The Charles Dickens of science journalism.
That'll be the quote that gets taken out and put at the top of the podcast.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. We're going to start this week by celebrating a largely ignored feat of animal achievement. It's the 50th anniversary of Ham the Astro Chimp's incredible adventure into and back from space. What? You've never heard of French Cameroon's greatest claim to fame? Well, keep listening. To talk us through this, we've got Henry Nichols in the studio. You might remember he was recently here talking about pandas. He seems to be on a quest to catalogue all of the world's fascinating animals, and we're only too happy to help him spread the word. Henry, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've brought a recording in on something called Minidisc.
Yes, it was recorded, something I recorded several years ago. I was in Washington, D.C. for a conference, and always on the lookout for celebrity animals and their stories. That's something that,
as you can tell,
I'm particularly interested in. And I'd heard about this space chimp, this Ham the chimp, and knew that his 50th anniversary was coming up. It's just 50th anniversary of his space flight, just gone. And so I thought I'd find out as much as I could about him, particularly about his life after death. It sounds a bit macabre, but I wanted to sort of resurrect him in a way and bring his story to life a bit. So I went to see what remains of him. And they're housed away out of sight at the National Museum of Health and Medicine in a northern suburb of Washington, D.C.
Now, we're going to try and play this, and I mean, Andy's been working on this for some time now. Have you managed to get it to work?
Yeah, so Henry's brought in a mini disc, but he's also had to bring in the mini disc player as well, because we don't have that kind of technology here at The Guardian. But I do have a wire that I can plug into it, so here we go.
Completely mechanical.
Well, what I'm going to do, I'm going to press play and see what happens. What track do you want me to play?
Track one.
It's whirring away. You might be able to hear it.
Well, here I am. It's a bright and beautiful autumn morning.
You sound a bit like David Attenborough.
And I've trekked.
I always do, yeah.
Against the rush hour out of downtown DC.
You have to go forward about eight. Let's try three, four, five. Just keep going.
So this is three.
It'll be in the museum again. Just right, keep going.
Well, here I am.
Next one.
Crisp.
That's it. We're back. I don't know how I managed to get all this.
Spent the last half hour travelling out of Washington.
Track 21.
And I'm here to visit the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. It's been, I have to confess, a little bit daunting walking into this huge military complex with a number of army-clad people. Is quite extraordinary, and they're all wielding guns and doing all sorts of security checks. So I was thinking I wouldn't get the microphone out and start recording for fear of being...
I think there'd been a scandal there, actually, quite recently. So journalists knocking around with
like, this is almost akin to war reporting, isn't it?
It was for me, yeah. I didn't want to tell them I was there to go and see this chimpanzee. I thought they just... I don't know what they'd have done with me. I just said, I'm here to see a space chimp.
The National Museum of Health and Medicine, which is associated with the Institute of Pathology here.
Ham was the first American in space. How did he get there?
He was born in the French Cameroons in, we think, June 1957. And the Air Force, the US Air Force, was trying to do some experiments, sending up animals and things in rockets, and they were obviously in the wake of the Sputnik success, they wanted to get on with a manned space program. So they thought they saw some chimps. They signed a contract with some dealers in French Cameroons to just get loads of chimps. And they went out there in 1960 and brought back 15 chimpanzees, and Ham was one of them.
They just brought them over and strapped one of them into a rocket. So what happened? So Ham was brought over.
Received several months training, and that went in three phases.
Training in what?
Training in...
operating space control.
That's right. Yes.
That kind of thing.
Yes, no, they wanted to see how the chimpanzee performed in space. So they needed to acclimatise it basically to being strapped down for hours on end in a tiny, tiny space, so that it wouldn't go completely berserk when it went up in space. So they started rather gently, just training it to pull some levers in response to red, white and blue lights flashing at it. And the chimps can do this very well, of course. And then they restrained it in these, what they call a couch, which is a sort of a fiberglass thing that they moulded to the individual chimpanzee's body. And it's pretty much what the astronauts were going to go up in. And if they pulled the right lever in response to the light, they got a banana pellet. And if they didn't pull it within 5 seconds or whatever, they got a small electric shock to the foot. And then if thirsty, as a result of eating banana chips, then they needed to do some more performance, get some other things right to get some water reward.
So they were trained to do all of this. What I'm assuming they weren't trained for was the terrifying feeling of being shot into space, the G-forces, all of that. I mean, what happened to Ham as he went up?
It doesn't really appear in the news reports afterwards, funny enough, that the NASA, who'd then taken control of the chimp, even though he remained an Air Force, the property of the Air Force.
Was he actually an Air Force officer? Did they give him a commission?
Kind of, yes.
He kind of deserved it, right?
He did. And they didn't really talk about it, but the footage, there is footage of him that shows him pretty terrified on takeoff and re-entry. He seems fine during his 6 minutes of weightlessness, and he's there just pulling his levers quite happily and moving around. But he was clearly pretty terrified. And so the nose cone crashed into the sea, and they recovered it, and he was fine, very happy. And all those shots are remarkable. This, you know, very, very cheerful, buoyant chimp just coming out of this, you know, basically doing interviews. They open the capsule, and there's a guy with a microphone just, you know, doing an interview with the chimp.
What was he expecting him to say? If he's been into space, he must have learned English
well,
by now.
Well, this is what I'm fascinated
Something's
in.
Happened.
The way that this and obviously other animals have been totally anthropomorphized or used or exploited by humans. And he became something very much more human than, you know, chimpanzees are pretty darn human, but there's can be very few chimpanzees that have been taken to the level that he was. He became just a national celebrity.
I mean, he must have been studied and prodded and poked afterwards, but how much do we know about what he felt or what he was thinking or anything like that? I mean,
Not much, during
the trip.
Frankly, we can only infer it from just looking at it and going, he can tell he's frightened. But they did, after the flight, try to get him to go on a subsequent flight, and it's quite well documented that whenever he saw that nose cone or a similar thing, that he just absolutely freaked out. So he was retired effectively after that. And then he went to the National Zoo in 1963 and was a sort of celebrity there, really, for till 1980.
People came to visit him.
People came to visit the space chimp, the astro
Did
chimp.
He get his choice of chimp ladies?
He didn't. That was about part of the problem. It was rather not really the best place to have him. There were no other chimps at the National Zoo at that time. So in 1980, he moved to North Carolina Zoo, where there was a colony of chimps, and apparently struck up a relationship with a chimp called Maggie.
Well, here I am in Washington, D.C., and I've come to the National Air and Space Museum.
Now, we heard you earlier on the minidisc setting the scene in Washington, and you were there for a very specific reason, to speak to someone very important in the afterlife of Ham.
That's right. His skeleton was retained by the Air Force, and so I went to see it. And here's the curator at the National Museum of Health and Medicine, Brian Spatola.
This is a collections area for the anatomical section of the National Museum of Health and Medicine.
And just 5 meters or so from your desk, there's a drawer, and you're just about to open it. Inside is this chimpanzee that I've come to see.
Right, this is the remains of Ham.
So after Ham's death in 1983, there was a plan to stuff his skin and put it back inside this capsule on display at the National Air and Space Museum, the Smithsonian. And there are some other space monkeys that have been preserved like that. But there was a massive uproar, basically, in New York Times editorials that this was just not on. Now, not all of him is here, just a skeleton, so...
I believe the rest was buried somewhere. It's at a space center. I couldn't tell you exactly.
Very tastefully, his skin and viscera were cremated and buried at the National Cemetery for Space Heroes in New Mexico.
To do the autopsy, just to look and see if there's any long-term effects of space flight that he might have shown. And there were none. And after the autopsy, he was... the remains stayed here under the AFIP number, which is just an accession number.
But scientists learn from these experiences? I mean, there must have been a point to this, scientifically.
The point really was, how will something approximating a human do without actually having to send up a human? So Alan Shepard, the first American astronaut who got into space, he didn't orbit the Earth, but was in space a little bit later. He was ready to go instead of Ham. And NASA wasn't quite ready. They wanted to avoid what they thought might be the most expensive funeral ever. So they did this test flight with Ham, and it's rumoured, I've got not very much evidence to support it, but it's a lovely idea that Alan Shepard was forever bitter with Ham for sort of pipping him into space, because if Shepard had gone, he'd have beaten Gagarin into space, but he didn't, and in his flight was put back to May, and in the intervening period he was sort of beaten by Gagarin, and he had to put up, and it's pretty clear he had to put up with a lot of chimp gags for a long time, for the rest of his career.
So these two didn't become friends afterwards?
Well, at Ham's funeral there's this lovely letter where the space cemetery invited Alan Shepard to attend the funeral in 1983, and a letter back from Alan Shepard saying, no, he had other engagements. I can't think of anything more important than attending that funeral. So that's basically the evidence that he was a bit bitter.
It's tenuous, but we'll take it.
So cleaning up these bones, then, how does that happen?
This one went to the Smithsonian. They have a dermestid colony, which is a type of beetle that likes to eat dried dead tissue. And so the dermestid colony that they keep out there for cleaning their specimens, making osteological preparations, was used. And that's how he was cleaned.
You could still see some of these pupae of the larva. These beetles that had sort of eaten away the flesh. You could still see some of these pupae, and also bits of wax left over from... As a forensic anthropologist came in about 1998, I think, and she wanted a cast, strangely, of his pelvis. I'm not quite sure what teaching materials, but anyway, she's got this website, and you can
now buy a cast of Ham's pelvis bone for $160.
Yeah, today's prices. I don't know how much they originally were.
Actually, 3 or 4 years on, it's still the same price.
Well, thanks very, very much for showing me that.
Oh, certainly.
If you want to know more about Ham's life and death, go to Henry's website, thewayofthepanda.blogspot.com. Follow Henry on Twitter as well. He's Way of the Panda, all one word. By the way, Science Weekly's just broken through the 2,000 followers mark on Twitter. Thanks for joining up. And if you're not already following us, look for @ScienceWeekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And for the rest of the Guardian Science content, go to @GuardianScience. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. Okay, so producer Andy, do you want to come over to this side of the glass for a minute?
Okay.
Now, the people behind the Large Hadron Collider have just announced they're going to keep it going longer than previously thought. The LHC will now run through 2011 and 2012, rather than shutting down for more than a year at the end of 2011, as previously planned. Andy, now, out of all of us here, you were most recently at CERN.
Yes, I was lucky to go back in December, and you may remember we did a particularly lovely podcast from there, still available to listen to online if you want. At that point, they just switched off the LHC for its spring cleaning, and unfortunately, the cavern still wasn't open. They had to sweep up all the kind of Higgs bosons and things like that, I think. But to say I was devastated is a bit of an understatement. I wanted my picture down there in front of that big digital camera, Atlas.
So who have you got on the line?
Well, it's the guy with possibly the best job title in the world. Do you mind introducing yourself?
Hi, yes, my name is Paul Collier. I'm my job title, the best one in the world, is Head of the Beams Department here at CERN.
Head of Beams at CERN, that's awesome. Now, I begged you to go down into one of the caverns or in the tunnel to do this podcast recording from there, but you couldn't, could you?
No, we're as you mentioned, we're just about to switch back on the machine after this technical stop over Christmas, and we're in the process of testing the various elements. And for that reason, quite a lot of the equipment is switched on. So we have huge water cooling systems, ventilation systems, etc. So it would sound a little bit noisy down there. In fact, we probably wouldn't be able to hear ourselves think, let alone speak.
That's exactly what I was after, actually, that kind of noise and the pistons turning and things like that.
So it wasn't possible down there because of disturbing the tests as well. So what I've done is the next best thing. I've come here to the main control center. Here at CERN, this is where we run all the particle accelerators at CERN, where all the testing is taking place, if you like, in preparation for putting beam back into the machine. So there is a fair amount of activity around me in this room as they slowly crank up the machines ready to take beam again very soon.
Can you just describe the control room to us? What does it look like? Are there levers and dials and flashing lights and monitors and things and noises like lightsabers?
There's a guy just behind me. He's looking at into the access system. This is the system that lets people into and out of the machine. I'm in the LHC part of the control room at the moment. At the moment, they're checking if everybody's out of a certain zone of the machine so they can close it completely in order to switch on and do some tests. The room itself is very large. It's about 1,500 square meters, thereabouts, so a third of an acre, if you want to put it that way. And basically it looks a little bit like a glorified television shop. There are hundreds of TV screens, about 50 big screens on the wall with SATA's displays, and then workstations all around. Everything, of course, is computer controlled. And it's split into four main corners. You may well have seen some of this on the on the TV when CERN was on the TV during the startup. There are four large arcs, each of which looks after a certain aspect of the operation of the complex. There are a few buttons and a few switches, but mainly it's computer controlled.
Does that mean that when you switch the beam on, it's actually a mouse click rather than a big red button?
It's more mouse clicking than it is button. We haven't got a button saying start and another one saying stop. The main systems where we use, if you like, mechanical buttons are the safety systems, where you have, instead of computer controlled, you have hardwired links to the safety systems. So there we have keys and buttons and switches. But the rest of it is all computer controlled. So I'm afraid it's not quite as good as a dirty great big red button that you press and say go.
Paul, just take us through how the beams are created at CERN.
a particle accelerator, you can imagine it a little bit like a car. It's very good at going at a certain speed, but it's not necessarily optimized if it's only got a single gear to go from a standing start to a very high speed all in one go. So, you know, if you buy a Porsche, you would like to have a Porsche with several gears so you can start off slowly and crank up to a very high speed. Accelerators are a little bit like that as well. You have accelerators which are optimized for a certain energy range, and the LHC, of course, is optimized for an extremely high energy beam. So in the LHC complex, we've got several other accelerators that, if you like, act as first, second, third, and fourth gear to bring the beam to the point at which it can be put into the machine. The beam itself has probably gone about 6 million kilometers by the time it actually is injected into the LHC for the first time through a series of smaller machines. The beam starts as in a bottle of hydrogen and then is accelerated through four different accelerators, each one, if you like, boosting it to the next stage, then passing it on to the next machine, which does the same thing. On and on until it can get to the energy sufficiently high to reach the LHC. And that process takes about 20 seconds. It can be repeated every 20 seconds.
Now, I'm going to bring in massive author Ian Sample. Ian, it's interesting that the beam's been is going to carry on at a time when the Tevatron, the Fermilab accelerator in Chicago, Illinois rather, it's been announced that that's not going to carry on. So it's a kind of an interesting time in particle physics.
That's right. I mean, Paul, it'd be great to get your thoughts on this. I mean, the LHC was originally going to close down in 2012 for, say, 12 months, 18 months. And then we had news that the Tevatron was actually not going to get the three-year extension, the Tevatron being your sort of your prime competitor in the hunt for some of these physics results. But now there is still this decision, the recent decision that has come out of Chamonix, that actually the LHC will now run for a year longer at half the energy. And what is the rationale for that? The Tevatron competition had essentially backed away. Why not take the time, do the work, and go up to full energy?
I think, I mean, the first thing is that the decision concerning the LHC was not taken, was not related to the discussion concerning the Tevatron. Tevatron and LHC were always complementary. Of course, they were both chasing the Higgs for the first time, but the LHC decision wasn't related to whether or not the Tevatron were in competition. Instead, I think the decision is much more straightforward. The machine, when we switched it on last year, worked fantastically, better than anybody could possibly have expected beforehand. The rate at which we could increase the collisions, if you like, the rate at which we could produce data, increased a factor of 200,000 in the 7 months over the operation of the machine, and we know now how to push it up even higher in a relatively short period of time. So the machine is working really, really well. On the other side, the four experiments, the four big experiments around the LHC, are in an incredible state of readiness to take that data and to analyze it. And they've all also realized that their detectors, if you like, are better prepared than they thought, and they can make do with less information in order to determine the existence of the Higgs or not than the original plans. So in the end, the decision came down to, should we take a beautifully working machine, which is perfectly capable of discovering or not excluding the Higgs in the next 2 years, and shut it down and take it apart and put it together again, or should we just spend the time that we have now with the machine working really well, do the work we need to get the question of the Higgs settled, and then we will take the time to switch off the machine, correct it, and go up yet another step in energy where we hope there will be even more physics to come.
Paul, you had this disastrous short circuit and helium leak a few years back that shut the LHC down for quite a while. How much is that event sort of playing on minds there at the moment? Are people still kind of nervous about turning the dial up?
it plays in our minds only in the sense that we know that there are weaknesses in these joints. The actual faults that created the problem in 2008 has been corrected, and we've checked there are no more faults along those lines anywhere in the machine. But there is a weakness in the stabilizing copper around these joints, which means that the machine is a little more sensitive than it should be at the very highest energies. Basically, we're playing the game very cautiously. We've set an energy for operation which is safe after all our analysis, and we will not go up in energy until such a time as we've corrected this problem. We had a big discussion in our workshop in Chamonix about whether we should go from 3.5 TeV, which is where we run at the moment, to 4 TeV. Relatively small step, but it was a long discussion looking into all the aspects of these the safety of the machine, etc. And we decided in the end that we're better off staying where we are and pushing the performance of the machine as high as possible.
Paul Collier there, he's head of beams at CERN. There's a link to that story on our Facebook group. Search for The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Read this. I'm forcing you to read it. You got to read it. Okay.
Following in the footsteps of Tolstoy, Shakespeare, J.K. Rowling, and massive author Ian Sample, we have another literary leviathan in the studio. Actually, it's just me. I've got a new book out called How to Live Forever and 34 Other Really Interesting Uses of Science. My agent, if I had one, would say that I'm too busy to come on this podcast, probably. So instead, here's a clip of me discussing it in The Guardian's Books podcast.
Alok Jha, you thought you were here just to introduce the clip from the Books podcast, but after the grilling you gave Ian about his book, we couldn't let you get away with it. So, Ian and Robin, could you have a look under your seats, please?
Oh, I brought mine up.
Where'd you get them from?
It's sellotaped underneath your chair.
Oh, no way! It's sellotaped underneath. I brought my own. I didn't realise it was actually physically...
Oh, is that what it was? It was actually sellotaped on the floor.
Yes, Alok, you have a book out, How to Live Forever and 34 Other Really Interesting Uses for Science. Now, I called up your publisher, but they didn't have any copies of your book left. That either means it's incredibly popular, or they restricted your print run to 28 copies. But a special courier has delivered them hot off the press from the warehouse. We only got them last night.
But we read them all night.
Yeah, we're going to review it. We have Nell Bowes, Robin McKee and Ian Sample in the studio.
Is my microphone even on?
Yes.
Okay. Carry on. I'm enjoying this.
How did you get it down to 34? Or 35, including How to Live Forever?
Are you actually asking me this question?
Yeah, I want to know. How did you decide on 35?
You see, it's not an interesting answer to this question. I was just told to do 35.
Oh, yeah.
Arbitrary.
You know, they wanted a manageable number, and I needed to know that I could finish it in just a couple of months. That's why.
A few months.
It's very blue, isn't it?
It's very blue. Why did you want to write it?
I had nothing else to do. Produce it so the mum can actually understand what I do. That's basically what it is.
So is it aimed at your mum?
Well, she can probably read it. I sent one to my parents this weekend, so I'm hoping they're reading it now. I don't think they've not rung me or anything. Normally they'd ring and say something, but they haven't. So obviously they've not even opened it yet. And I think that all the people I know who've got it have been given it for free by somebody, including me. So I'm not sure if anyone has actually bought it yet. But, you know,
Do you go and check on Amazon?
I don't know how you do that. I mean, does it tell you?
Shut.
Does it tell you?
On Amazon. What's Amazon?
I've seen it on Amazon, but I don't know how you check how many copies it sells.
You can't check how many
copies it sells.
You can see how popular or unpopular.
People write reviews.
How do you know that? How do you do that?
Because it says customer review.
You look for the really large number, and that's where yours ranks.
Oh, I see. Mine doesn't even have a number.
I actually wanted to say something about your book, because I've had it a bit longer than these guys, and I have gone through it, and I don't. It pains me to praise you. It really does. But
so don't.
Look, I read a lot of science books, and often they remind me how hard science is. But there was something I really liked about this, where you're reading through and you've gone through an enormous range of topics, and you read it and you think, oh, okay, it works like that. And
And it actually feels very simple. And I found that really enjoyable. And that's enough of that. Apart from that, I hate it all.
How to Live Forever. And the second one is How to Start a Plague. I mean, what kind of thinking is that?
Well, if you are going to have people living forever, you need some way of killing them as well to be immortal.
What you could have done, actually, was you could have taken any of these chapters and turned them into books in their own right. Your chapter 8, How to Put the World in Order. That deserves more than 4 pages.
I want to ask a serious question. Think you have condensed them all down to 4 pages, which is amazing. How do you decide what the basics are? How do you decide whether to say, oh, well, when I mention a photon, I'm going to have to explain what I mean, or I'm going to talk about gravitons and I think that needs a bit of explanation or doesn't, or how do you work that out?
Well, there is a glossary, but... It's a good question, this. I think the chapters in that book are basically for anyone who is intelligent but doesn't have the facts. And so you can say photon, comma, particle of light. And even if that doesn't make sense to someone, it kind of is enough of a, let's say, a short letter abstraction or whatever it is, that you can carry on to the next step. And I think that's enough. And I think it's exactly the same as we do on newspapers. That's what it is. It's that sort of level. This is basically a bunch of features for newspapers. It's that sort of audience, I think.
I only got a copy last night and I had to read it in the tube in this morning. And as a kind of measure of my friendship with you, I was prepared to sit in public and read something with your name on top. No, that's the kind of thing that I will do for you.
That's
and
really
having
nice
said,
of
having,
you.
Having said that, I think it's really very, very good.
Oh,
and
thanks.
The chapters I read, I thought were... How to Spot a Pseudoscientist, I thought was really, you know, very, very good chapter, summing the issues up. I think you've done a very, very good job. And can I have the 50 quid now?
I was very touched by your introduction, actually, Alok. It really struck a chord. About your science teacher.
Yeah,
and about him, you know, saying, well, work out how hot the sun is, and then kind of leaving the room and leaving you to sort of work it out by hook or by crook.
Yeah, and Boyle's Law, all of that stuff. No,
it's brilliant.
And it's absolutely true.
It reminds me a bit of my dad.
It isn't even made up. That's actually true. And that is the reason I did physics at university.
What was your teacher's name? Should you give him a shout out?
Well, actually, his name is... Well, we called him Digger, you see, so I can't remember his first name, which is awful.
Did you go to school in Grange Hill?
No. We called him Digger Barnes, actually. But he's died now. But he was an awesome, awesome teacher.
So all you guys like the book. Now, in the interests of balance, I don't like it. And it's not because of the colour of the cover. I've got a bone to pick with you. I was casually leafing through and reached the acknowledgement section. Ian's there. He gets a mention.
Am I?
Nell's there.
Oh, do I get... My first acknowledgement.
You got the editor of the newspaper. Yeah.
Suck he got up. Me. He got
Brown.
Me.
Has he got you?
He's got me.
Has he?
Robin
McKee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a producer, Andy, there or anything? Is there a serious omission been made? I need to complain to the publishers here?
I use this podcast to do my non-science stuff. That's what I've always thought. You'll get an acknowledgement in the non-science book that I write one day.
In Alok's great novel.
My great novel, which is coming out at some point. I am writing another book, by the way. You can have one in there.
What's your other book, Alok?
It's about how to destroy the world.
Really?
Yeah.
You've got a nuclear bomb section in this
there
one.
There is one, yeah. There is a nuclear bomb
section. So how do you destroy the world?
There are many ways. You'll find out in November this year.
35 ways to destroy the world.
50, actually.
50?
Yeah. 2 books in 1 year.
Well, you know, I'm nothing but productive.
The Charles Dickens of science journalism.
That's right, yeah.
That'll be the quote that gets taken out at the top of the podcast.
Producer Andy will get a first billing as inspiration for why you want to write a book about destroying the world.
Okay, well, let's wrap that up. That's enough of a plug. Nell, are you planning on writing one?
I don't. I'm one of those few people that doesn't have a book in them, and I'm quite proud of that. Many of my friends have written novels over the years, some of them extremely good, but I do not have a book in me.
Okay, Alok Jar's How to Live Forever and 34 Other Really Interesting Uses for Science is available at guardianbooks.co.uk.
Is it?
I expect so. I'll check.
I didn't know that.
If not, Amazon.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Warning, the following section contains content of an explicit sexual nature, albeit animal-based. Ian, who have you been on the phone to?
I got an interview with Isabella Rossellini.
Mostly an actress.
From Blue Velvet and Death Becomes Her and loads of other things.
I play human most of the time, so this time I play animals.
Filmmaker, author, philanthropist, and also a a Lancome model, I think, for years and years and years. She's in British Vogue and things like that. The reason I called her up is she's done a series of short films that go on the web and go around the various film festivals on animal sex and animal seduction rituals. And seven of those are going to appear in a new exhibition at the Natural History Museum in London, an exhibition called Sexual Nature.
Green Porno is about the mating habits of animals, and Seduce Me is about the courtship rituals of animals.
Bedbugs have penises like knives. Females don't need any genitals to mate. Stab me!
Chase me!
They're very short. They're about a minute and a half or 2 minutes each. They start with a close-up of me saying,
if I were a fly, a common one, a Mosca domestica.
And I quickly transform myself into a fly with very complicated and beautiful costumes.
You would try to swat me. You can't catch me. My eyes see movement 200 times better than human eyes. That newspaper coming at me looked really slow.
And I would mate this way, and I would show how a fly would mate, or a praying mantis would mate, or a duck. They are meant to be comical films because, you know, there's many ways to make babies to reproduce. And so they're meant to be short little comical film, but scientifically accurate. So that I had hoped that my reaction went from a laugh to, oh, I didn't know that.
If I were a dragonfly, I would have compound eyes.
The male has a sexual organs that can clean the female sexual organ.
I would find a female, and I would grab her with them by the neck.
Because the female tend to be very promiscuous.
She would twist a body to get to my genital pouch. But first, I would clean her vagina to make sure she would only have my babies. Then we would copulate. When finished, I don't let her go, but would drag her where I want her to lay our eggs.
Little things like this that I always found comical. It's not that I'm particularly interested just in the sex life of animals, but I knew that there were much more interest in sex than there is in other subjects about animals. So that's why we concentrated on the sexual behavior of animals.
If I were an earthworm, I would have no brain.
If I did an hermaphrodite animal like the earthworm, then I would do maybe an animal that changes sex in his life, but is not an hermaphrodite. An hermaphrodite is something that is
both male and female.
And there are animals that are born male and become female, or vice versa. So that I would make sure that I would have differences of example of this incredible variety of ways to reproduce.
First, I'd push the clitellum to collect my eggs. Then, to collect my partner sperm. Then, I slip it over my head and drop it to the ground. My little worms will be born in 2 to 3 weeks.
When the first eight film came out, it turned out to be successful. I was contacted by several scientists, actually. And so with a few of them, I started a collaboration, and actually two of them now became part of our staff.
Pizza Napoletana with tomatoes, cheese, and anchovies.
I think anchovies, I loved it.
Anchovies?
The anchovies, they are in a school, and obviously I was one fish among many. We made a background that was blue. I wore the same blue leotard and a hat like an anchovy.
I would live in a group, a school of anchovies. The best position is to be in the middle of the group. Let me stay in the middle. Let me in. Let me in!
To be in the middle is safe, because if there is a predator, you're obviously in the middle and you might have a better chance to escape than the one at the periphery. But on the other hand, you're getting all the pee and the waste of the one that is in front of you, and there isn't enough oxygen. So you are always torn as an anchovy to be at the periphery so you can be clean and breathe well and also be inside, so to be protected.
We anchovies do everything together, even mating, in big orgies. Eggs and sperm would mix and our babies will be born out of these orgies called spawning.
The one that comes to mind is the duck, the female duck. Not that she has a very interesting sexual life, but she has a very interesting vagina. She has a vagina with a lot of dead ends.
Oh, they all want to mate with me with their corkscrew penises.
Female ducks are often raped very violently by a group of male, and she has evolved a vagina where if she is raped, but she decides that that shouldn't be fathering her ducklings, she can send him to a dead end.
My vaginal structure is a twisted tunnel, a labyrinth.
If she is mated by a male that she likes and things would be good for her babies, then she would let him go to the channel that leads to her eggs. And I thought that would be extraordinary.
Hey, you, Drake. I want you to be my husband. A little to the left. There. There are my eggs. Oh, you will father my babies.
We assume that everybody is dictated by survival. And yet the male bee that would mate with the queen bee knows that he would die after the mating. And he dies because his penis will get stuck in her reproductive organs. And it's also the way to guarantee that he would be fathering the babies. There wouldn't be others.
His brother would fight! I'm the strongest! I would fly after her! I would mate her in flight.
I don't know. I don't know why the sexual life of animals hasn't been described before. I think it was because maybe we're a little bit prudish. One of the scientists that consults with me is Claudio Campagna. He's a marine biologist.
Ask, ask, ask.
Claudio was complaining that the environmental message has become too doom and gloom, and he felt that he recruited as many people as he could. But then he alienated some, and so he was attracted to the idea of something comical to lure people in.
Biologist Claudio Campagna.
It's not really bad to consume anchovies in pizza.
So we did do 3 episodes of Green Porno, which we called Bon Appetit. They start with me in the kitchen.
Many, many boats target these schools, and nets are thrown over them, and basically everything is being taken, leaving very little for other animals.
And Claudio provided me this fantastic footage that was filmed secretly, you know, to be exposed to all of us consumers of fish, to see the quantities of fish that is taken out of the ocean.
And this is one of the major causes of declining of species.
Claudio wanted to see if showing a film that was comical could attract the people that don't want to hear any more bad news from the environment, you know? So he just thought we need to change our message. We cannot keep on talking about the end of the world. This is, some people are just shutting off.
If I were a snail, I can withdraw my entire body into my shell, where I can hide my vagina and my penis. I have both. Sadomasochism excites me. Ah.
You can watch some of Isabella's videos in all their Technicolor glory. Other film colour schemes are available at sundancechannel.com/greenporno. Also on that website, by the way, they've got one of those things where you can work out your green porn name. Apparently, producer Andy's is Loco Lobo. Ian's is Willie Hemlock. It just sounds like he needs a wash. Nell's is Paula Pearlberry, a Harry Potter character, I think. Alok's, mine, is Archer White Ghost, which I sound like a lord or something. And Robin's, his is the best, Fabio Grappletail. They all sound like Lord of the Rings characters or Harry Potter characters, don't they?
By the way, we're chopping this whole item out for those US radio stations which take this program. It'd take me about a week, I reckon, to go through all the content advisories.
What a shame. Poor old US listeners. They'll have to download the podcast, I think.
Exactly.
That's it for another week. Thanks to Henry Nichols.
Paul Collier. And as was said, I've got the best job title in the world, the head of the beams department here at CERN.
Isabella Rossellini.
How often do you get to say that? Nell Bowes, Ian Sample, and Robin McKee. Next week, we're going to head out to a new exhibition opening at London's Natural History Museum. The good news, it's all about sex. And we're going to interview chemistry legend Peter Atkins. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. That's where you'll find 4.5 years of our programme archives, all free to download. guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Your jokey intro into your book, and then...
I'm not doing that.
Well, have I got to do it?
No, I'm not doing it.
At all?
It's not going to happen.
I'll have to do
it,
then.
There's too many sections in this podcast. I think that's the one can lose.
Hold on.
No, really.
That. It'd be funny. It's funny.
Okay, so I'm being forced to read this. I'm hoping he'll delete this. Okay, so and I didn't write any of these words, by the way. Just wanted to say, following in the footsteps of Tolstoy, Shakespeare, J.K. Rowling, and massive author Ian Sample, we have another literary leviathan in the studio. Yes, it's me. I have a new book out called How to Live Forever and 34 Other Really Interesting Uses of Science. Now, my agent, actually, I don't have an agent, but if I were...
You handle yourself?
I handle myself.
Yes, I have that.
Oh, you bastard.
Tell us about
it. I could, but aren't we going to do the news at some point as well?
No, we're not doing the news. That was made up.
That's what? A trick.
That was a trick.
Woo-hoo. Over here.
What? Well, we need to do the news, otherwise it makes no sense.
That's a great quote from Alan. We need to do the news.
There's stuff to talk about.
No, sorry,
it's a big schedule for me today.
Yeah, the news can't wait.
Yeah.
news sorry, plus man. Time equals fact.
You know, some of it.
I'm not going to sign your book, please. Now, no.
Yeah, man, I'm mine.
You've got
mine. Sign it, real authors.
I'm just working out whether to get you to sign my book. I don't know whether
that brings the price down.
Oh, does it?
If you put it gets you signs it, you can't put it on Amazon afterwards.
Oh,
you're
right,
such a bastard. Honestly, what have I done?
And we're not allowed to give these away, are we?
No.
One free with every podcast.
Not mine.
Now here follows a warning. What am I, old English?
Coming with all that I'm stuff. Not Woolly Hemlock. I did my porn name. I came out as something else.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh well.
I think you just make something up each time.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
I was right,
can we do this?
I was something limp cock or something. Woolly Hemlock.
The outtakes for this program would make a whole different podcast. Okay. Just before you go, can you make sure you sign my book there, please? And can you amend the acknowledgements? Yeah. Andy Duckworth, big letters, capitals. Thanks.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.